What's up, gang? Van Jackson here. A while back, a friend of the pod asked me what subscriptions I'd recommend for news and analysis on world politics. And it was actually a hard question to answer on the spot, believe it or not. But I've got a great answer now. Mother effin' World Politics Review. If you're a fan of Undiplomatic, you should be reading World Politics Review. It's obviously worldly. It's in the title. It's not obsessed with Trump. And it has a great mix of analysis and journalism. Also, why do you think I'm doing this pitch? World Politics Review is an official sponsor of the show. And the best way to back us right now is to back them. So give them a chance. They're offering a 25% discount subscription for Undiplomatic listeners. And if you want to subscribe to their daily newsletter, which you should, you can do it for free. Just visit wpr.pub/undiplomatic. That's wpr.pub/undiplomatic. That'll get you the free newsletter. It'll also provide you the code for the 25% discount should you want to subscribe. So get on the train, wpr.pub/undiplomatic. Peace. What's up, gang? Van Jackson here. Before we get into the episode, I just wanted to give you a little forewarning that the quality of the recording of this episode is a little fucked up. I made some bad choices experimenting with how we do the recording. Did not pay off, but instead of junking the episode, I wanted to give you a chance to listen to it. So we had there's a lot of good shit in here. You just have to tolerate some like very bad audio. Won't happen again. We'll be back to normal next week. Peace. What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson, and the team is here today. We got Kiara Mitchell.
Hello.
Pete McKenzie.
Hey, yeah.
Gabby Magnuson.
What's up?
And Jake Dello.
Salutations, comrades.
Dude, so there's so much to talk about. Shout out to Matt Duss, who I just found out gave this really awesome interview to Jacobin Magazine. I'm not co-signing Jacobin because, guess what? Not a Marxist. They're deeply faithful Marxists. They flirt with like progressive ideas because there's a certain amount of solidarity between you know progressivism and socialism, but like progressivism is not equal to socialism outright in the Marxist sense. Again, not co-signing Jacobin Magazine, which is hit and miss. Some of their stuff is good. Some of their stuff is a little radical. But the interview is really money because he talks about the foreign policy establishment and how his views on foreign policy, but like limits of trying to build a career in Washington as a policy person. If you speak truth to power, if you speak your mind, if you write things and go on the record that sort of diverge from the prevailing Washington consensus of the moment, whatever that is. Basically, if you push back on conventional wisdom, you get blowback in all sorts of ways in terms of like your brand, the attention you can attract, the opportunities you get. There's all kinds of countervailing pressure from funders and trade-offs between making noise on foreign policy and trying to advance a domestic policy agenda. And domestic politics is usually takes priority. So anyways, it's a long read, good read, not a Marxist, but it's a great, we'll put it in the show notes. So shout out to Matt for giving a money interview. And we just woke up to news that Steve Bannon got arrested.
Yep.
This is
weird.
So weird.
Yep.
So Bannon is getting arrested for fraud relating to border wall fundraising schemes. Yeah. But he was arrested on a super yacht that was actually built by a Kiwi and then sold. Yeah. And then sold to a Chinese billionaire criminal exile named Miles Kwok. And I think he has like a different Chinese name, obviously, but he, is on China's most wanted list for fraud, money laundering, and a bunch of white collar crime. And so he's like holed up in the US, I think in New York, as like a sort of like refugee in limbo. And so he forged, he met Bannon in like October 2017 and forged ties with him. He started paying Bannon a bunch of money. I mean, in the millions of dollars. And this is all like New York Times, Wall Street Journal has all covered this shit over the past 2 years, but we forget because we all have fucking lizard brains now. And yeah. Basically, like, this guy is a criminal in China who is assuming the pose of an activist and an anti-CCP, like, champion of democracy. And this is not really true. It's he lost a political, like, power struggle. And now he is representing, like, he has, like, the best intentions or whatever. And he's trying to bring down the CCP because they're evil. He's not wrong about that. But he's taking that position because he's wanted for all manner of crimes. And he's funneling money to Bannon. And so there's this follow the money problem with the anti-China movement. So, like, to the extent that Washington seems like it's overly aggressive on China, you can look at money from fucking Miles Guac pushing that, promoting that. Like, it's adding an inflammation to the, you know, China villainy movement that Bannon was trying to run.
The issue that this Chinese dissident had with China so much isn't what they do, it's that he isn't the one doing it.
He's a criminal in China, yeah. But like, yeah. In any system, his activities would have been criminal. And he's just represent, since he's on the losing side of China, he's saying, well, now we need to take China on. So it's like he's laundering his own crimes as justice or whatever.
There's anyways, so much wrong about this era in world politics. But the real beauty of it is that there's always just this incredible poetic justice in whatever happens. Yeah. Like it just plays like a movie script at every turn.
It's crazy to me how every single fucking decision on like the global stage nowadays seems to actually be motivated by very personalistic, corrupt, like reasoning. Like there is no sense that people are playing strategy games except the strategy of enriching themselves. It's maybe that's how it's always been. China is helping Saudi Arabia. For one thing, they're like, they're doing missile transfers to Saudi Arabia, but they're helping them build a uranium enrichment facility to produce yellow cake, which is a key input to nuclear weapons. And the Trump administration, because they're close to Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi Arabia, they're keeping silent about this and sort of indirectly facilitating this. And so once again, it's like you're undermining yourself, this whole charade of being like China's the supervillain. There are some true believers in the administration, but administration policy on the whole does not show that, does not reflect that. And this is one of the examples of that. Like the U.S. is indirectly permitting, turning a blind eye to China facilitating Saudi Arabia's going nuclear. And Saudi Arabia has an interest in going nuclear precisely because Iran is closer to going nuclear. And Iran is closer to going nuclear because we walked away from the Iran nuclear deal. So we're creating this anti-virtuous circle of nuclear proliferation in the Middle East that is, I don't know, empowering China indirectly. And it's more dangerous for all. We lose political influence. And all the while, Pompeo is refusing to testify before Congress because my man Joaquin Castro is trying to call him to account, basically. Like, what's the U.S. position on this? What's the U.S. role in this? Is this really even happening? Like, just testify before Congress. And Pompeo is not. When I posted this on Slack, Gabby's first question was, is that legal?
I mean...
As if whether it was legal mattered at all anymore.
Sorry.
Is it legal is not a question that happens in the decision-making process anymore. That we're way past legal being the guiding rationale for decisions. So yeah, this is funny. Actually, no, Gabby's thing is funny. This thing is very disturbing because this is nuclear proliferation in the Middle East, man. And it's at and we'll talk about this in Armchair Analysis. But like, it's sort of like foisting opportunity and political influence onto China at a moment when you say that China is the supervillain you're trying to take on. So on the best of days, you're contradicting yourself.
Let's do Prediction Market, where we get Van to predict outcomes from today's current events and keep track of them.
All right, for Prediction Market this week, question one, will France increase their military presence in Africa following the recent coup in Mali before December?
So I'm going to say no. A lot of that no has to do with, I don't understand what would be gained from a larger military presence in Africa. I just don't see it happening, or like I don't see what the benefit would be. But I also didn't know about this coup until I saw the BBC News article that you linked for this question. So
Mali has been the center for all things not very good for a while. And France has always been there because, like Algeria, they're sort of the old colonies. France still has somewhat of an input there in their stability. And this coup has sort of thrown off all attempts to demilitarize the country. And in fact, I think France might increase. I hope they don't. I hope you're right, Van, because militarization is never really a good thing. Question two, will Sudan follow through with their aspirations for peace with Israel in the same vein as the United Arab Emirates before November?
I really don't know anything about this, and I don't think Israel is on some like global peace initiative unless they're trying to somehow like help Trump, which I don't see how that would fit in here. So I'm going to say no, but I'm also going to use this opportunity to ponder out loud, is Prediction Market better as did this shit really happen? Because all these questions that you ask me every week are so fucking just in the weeds, they sound like they're not real every time.
Well, you know,
and so like, well, is the format better instead of like
of them do.
prediction?
I have to defend my integrity here.
Where do you come up with this shit?
Silly me. I just expected my ex-professor in international relations internationally minded, because I look all over the world, people, for ideas.
That's fair. I mean, this is the one segment that brings in Africa and the Middle East. Like, we're definitely like heavy Asia.
I have to look, like, because it's, and I'm actually very careful to do this. A lot of countries like Mali and Sudan and the global south, as we would call it, often get overlooked. And oftentimes these are the tinderboxes to which these international disputes start. So I think the prediction market questions, they're pretty out of the blue. Like, who really knows if Sudan wants peace with Israel? Who wants peace with Israel? But,
well, I know.
Like, now people know Sudan maybe wants peace with Israel.
Maybe. Maybe.
Before we move on, I quite like the idea of like a segment which is just, did this shit really happen? It's quite a cool idea.
Question three, will we see any international pushback to the Russian COVID-19 vaccine being used and being tested in the Philippines in October, which is the first test?
Is this, I don't know whether to believe this. Like, I believe that the Russians are going to be giving Filipinos injections of something, but like,
oh, yeah.
Is it an actual vaccine?
Yeah.
No. So here's the thing, right? So this is the big thing that's been kind of blowing up. The vaccine didn't even pass the phase three of the testing kind of deal, but what's blowing up in the Philippines news-wise is that they're like all the interviewers and stuff are like, it's better than nothing, and trying to really push it. And I know the Philippines is desperate, but I really don't think that this vaccine, which most medical experts are like, you probably shouldn't do it, is legit.
I doubt it's legit. It's weird that the Philippines would take this risk with their public health. I question the notion of like Russia getting involved in Southeast Asia. On top of all of that, I kind of feel like if any country actually had a viable vaccine and they were not internationalizing it that you could end up having a kind of resource wars kind of situation very quickly. If Russia, if we thought Russia had a vaccine and there's 100,000 people in the US dying, that's the kind of calculation where it's like, well, maybe we need to go in there and fucking take it. You know, like that sounds like war, you know? The default is that somebody has an answer to stop deaths in your country and they're not giving it to you. So like this whole thing sounds like so sketchy and shady to me, but who knows? It's Duterte and Putin, so.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
Time for Save Twitter, where we curate the best and worst of Twitter so that you don't have to.
So for Stay Off Twitter this week, I've got two. One is from a dude named Max Berger. He was on the Warren campaign with me. I think he was like a higher level than I was. But he just says in this tweet, if you're upset about waste and inefficiency at the post office, just wait till you hear about the Pentagon. And that's pretty
so
sharp.
Good.
Yeah. And he's putting that tweet on top of a Bloomberg article that recorded the interviews report that the Pentagon had $35 trillion in accounting adjustments just last year. So accounting adjustments is like when you try to fudge numbers on your balance sheet to make the numbers work out. And when numbers don't work out, it's because there's an anomaly or something wrong, or you didn't follow procedures with how money is supposed to be allocated. So like you're just trying to make the balance sheet work. And to do that, you end up going through like accounting jujitsu. And it's when you see accounting adjustments that it's like when there's smoke, there's fire. Oh, it opens up the possibility that there is like a misallocation of funds, right? Or that something is happening that's not supposed to be happening. And that's not inherently the case because accounting adjustments happen all the time. But when you have $35 trillion worth of accounting changes, that is 38 times what your actual budget is. And your budget is already bigger than most countries. This is the impropriety that is just presumptive here is unbelievable. And everybody knows that like the Pentagon cannot pass an audit, that it's the ultimate form of like fraud, waste, and abuse. It's the ultimate form of fucking structural violence. Huge problem. Max Berger seems to know that. So I'm glad he brought the snark, humor, whatever you call it.
$35 trillion is so much money. I feel like sometimes you kind of lose track of how much things are.
It's so weird. It's so weird that so much money could keep getting plowed to the Pentagon and like you still are not being able to keep track of it. Like if you can't keep track of it, why do you keep sending it over, man? Second tweet from Aaron Connolly, who is a fellow at the IISS, which is a think tank that is, it has a presence in Southeast Asia. I think he's in Singapore, but it's also at in the UK and in DC. And he just says, I wonder how much time and political capital the Pompeo State Department spent lobbying Indonesia and Vietnam on this vote where American failure was never in doubt. And he's talking about the UN arms embargo vote on Iran, which failed. The Russians and the Chinese vetoed the arms embargo because they have veto power at the UN Security Council. And of course they're going to veto a new resolution on Iran, right? And then the abstentions included Vietnam and Indonesia, right? So Aaron Connolly is raising this like ultimate clusterfuck bad strategy situation here, because it's like, okay, so the US foreign policy apparatus invested how much time, how much effort, how much political capital in convincing Indonesia and Vietnam to not vote against them at the UN. But that misses the whole fucking point, because this was never going to pass because Russia and China were never going to support an embargo on Iran. So if you have no chance, if you have 0% chance of making a strategy work, why are you going to invest time in it? Why are you going to waste the apparatuses, everything? And this is, This is like a very small issue or a small thing. All of U.S. foreign policy in the Trump era, everything is time wasting. Everything is bad strategy. It's throwing good money after bad choices, good decisions after bad choices. This is why America is in like power free fall. Why we have, it's not just that Trump is a fucking loudmouth, amoral criminal. It's that like we are totally incompetent. And this is an example that proves it very clearly. There's no way you can argue that it was sane for Pompeo to be using effort to lobby Indonesia and Vietnam when you're not going to convince Russia and China anyway. So this is all stupid.
Yeah.
It's all stupid. We're living in fucking idiocracy of foreign policy.
So I've got the one for the week from Maggie J. It's a wee thread, definitely worth the read. So it goes off saying, again, I think this point needs to be made. There is no other political party in Western democracies where Black people have equal political power as in the Democratic Party. And certainly no party where Black, Latino, and Jewish people all share so much power together. She goes on saying how it should be a source of inspiration, and this fact is one of the better, unique American things. To be clear, though, Jay isn't saying that these groups aren't oppressed in America, but rather it's respected that in the Democratic Party, we can see Maxine Waters, Barbara Lee, Hakeem Jeffries, and Jim Clyburn like having the same power. Mind you, like underneath this tweet, I've been seeing kind of like mixed responses, so I just wanted to flag it down and get your take, man.
Yeah, I mean, so I think the point of this tweet thread is spot on. Like, I really like it. And it's true that the Democratic Party and the U.S. political system over the past generation or so has provided a platform for minorities to access power in to an unprecedented degree within America. The problem or the limitation is that there's a lot of tokenism that goes on, or like visual diversity. It's like, oh, well, that person is a woman. Right. Guess what? Tulsi Gabbard, conspiracy theorist, is a woman. That doesn't mean she would be a good president. You know what I mean? Hillary Clinton was an Uber hawk who might have gotten us into a bunch of endless wars. Would that meant have she's that she would have been a good president because she was a woman? No. Like, we're with Kamala Harris right now. Like, I mean, I'm on her team, but she is a visual representation of minority power. But whether she represents those minorities in terms of the decisions that she makes depends on the decisions that she makes. Cornel West, who's this, I don't even know how to describe him. He's a scholar, radical scholar in the US, but he was taking Jim Clyburn to task because he's Black from the South. He represents a lot of, I mean, his whole district is Black people, right? But he is in the pocket of Big Pharma. So he's getting paid off by the pharmaceutical lobby, and he votes for basically a 1990s style neoliberal agenda. And that does not serve the Black population. That serves a growing inequality in America. And so we have to be careful. And like, so the pushback on this tweet thread, I think, is that comes from a place of like avoiding being satisfied by the tokenism of like, even the Obama presidency, it's like, oh, we finally got a Black guy in the White House. But then most of the decisions he made did not serve Black people. They served Wall Street, right? That's why big tech is so fucking big, man. The decisions that you make, one of the arguments that I've heard a lot of Black people make is that Warren would have been the best president for Black people. And guess what? She's not Black. I mean, I guess you knew that. But she it's about the policies that you have. Like, are those supporting minority populations best? Are those in the best interests of who you are as an identity? And you can have people of any race and any gender supporting power structures or supporting the status quo, and that's not a good thing. But it is not, it's also no small thing. It's not trivial to be able to say that a Black man or a Black woman can be in the White House, you know? It is progress to be able to be born a woman or Latino or LGBTQ and still be able to climb the ladder of life, to still be successful in a conventional sense. Like, that is not a small thing either. So like, there's a duality here, but I appreciated that she was foregrounding some optimism.
Let's jump into Armchair Analysis, where we dive into a different piece every week and tell you all about it.
For Armchair Analysis this week, we've got a piece from Foreign Policy by an author called Puneet Talwar, titled China is Getting Mired in the Middle East. And it's all about a leak that we saw earlier this week that China and Iran are set to sign a kind of ambitious 25-year strategic partnership. And Talwar writes that the agreement is best understood through the lens of the Belt and Road Initiative, which aims to connect China economically with kind of major markets around the world. And that a partnership with Tehran would offer Beijing a really prime geostrategic foothold and allow it to complete a vital segment of the BRI corridor. Despite the fact that it's negotiating this partnership with Iran, China is also negotiating comprehensive strategic partnerships with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, countries which are not on friendly terms with Iran. And as we talked about at the start of this pod, China's also providing Saudi Arabia with yellow cake. So there's all sorts of, you know, interesting connections with kind of both sides of this Sunni-Shia regional strategic divide, which is interesting because, as Talwar writes, China's deep foreign policy instinct is to stay out of regional rivalries and wherever possible to sit on the fence. But the sheer dimensions of this prospective strategic partnership with Iran may well cause the Gulf monarchies and Israel to conclude that China has now decisively tilted in the direction of their nemesis. He goes on to say, what China sees as a win-win may be interpreted by countries in the region as playing both sides. The reason it's particularly interesting is because China has been able to stay out largely of the kind of regional shit fight that is the Middle East and other parts of the world in a way that the United States has been able to. The United States has been sucked into these endless wars and into kind of ongoing participation. And so it's interesting as we kind of come out of this unipolar moment that China is taking not only an assertive role, but an ongoing and committed role in these areas that could strengthen its strategic position or could weaken its strategic position. So it was a really interesting article, and Talwar takes the view that it might weaken China's strategic position. I mean, what did you think about it, Ben?
It was a great piece, and it really gets the sort of geopolitical imagination going. There's not a lot. So within the context of the Belt and Road Initiative, it makes sense that China would be pursuing these strategic comprehensive partnerships in the Middle East. And if you're trying to build an imperial foreign policy, that is precisely what you should be doing anyway. I've talked about before, I've written before about how these strategic comprehensive partnerships are these, it's a very smart play to create asymmetric bilateral agreements that privilege China, and then China just gives up some, you know, it creates an economic relationship, opens up trade or aid or investment ties or strengthens them. And in return, though, it gets all of these political promises that favor Beijing about unique access rights to certain ports, to prevent your airspace being used for anything that China would oppose, to forswear alliances that might ever tilt against China. And so it's just in the space of like rhetoric and political commitments, but that is, you're actively shaping and committing, you're creating symbolic ties that favor you. And it's on a one-on-one basis, and you're doing this across the entire span. That's the pattern of relationships that's of an imperial character, whether it's a formal empire or not. And if you're the United States and you're concerned about Chinese influence expanding, you should be concerned about that. How do you deconstruct that, right? How do you undermine this new hub and spoke system that China is structuring? And I feel like nobody in the US really thinks in those terms, but that the Middle East comes into focus in that context in my mind. And the question that the piece raises is whether China will get entangled in the Middle East in the way that the US has, which means like endless wars, and you end up getting invested in these, in a geopolitical sense, very small conflicts, but with high consequences that you wouldn't otherwise be invested in. You know, and that's going to be a huge diversion of resources, of time, of strategic effort. And that is totally possible. The thing that really fucked things up for the United States and the Middle East was its sort of like liberalism crusade. And China doesn't have that problem. You know, if China's authoritarian pose and the idea that you're just trying to transactionally, you know, maximize gains in each individual relationship, that could blow back on you if local actors, you know, get pissed off or target you for allying with the wrong country. But like, at any moment, China can just wash its hands of the situation and not feel like it's, you know, making some moral sacrifice. So like the absence of values in Chinese foreign policy might prevent them from getting dragged in a way. I don't know. That's how I sort of think about it, but it's of course hard to know.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, that seems right to me. I think the only limiting factor there is that China is also obsessed at a foreign policy level with building and maintaining a legitimacy and is this kind of manifestation of the individualized saving face kind of principle in Chinese society. And so, you know, I can totally see that holding back, you know, China exiting from the region because it doesn't want to be embarrassed in front of its cool friends.
All right, time for Ask Me Anything, where people ask me anything.
So this week for Ask Me Anything, we have three questions. The first one is from Anonymous. You say the phrase structural violence a lot. What do you mean by it?
So, yes, I do say that a lot. I think I said it today. It's an important concept. So in 1969, I think, or 68, Johann Galtung, he posited that peace, he wrote this article in Journal of Peace Research where he said that peace is the absence of violence, but violence comes in multiple forms. And so there's negative peace and positive peace depending on the type of violence that exists. And so violence can be literal violence, which is like perpetrated by individuals, which is what we think, like when we think of violence, it's like somebody attacking somebody. And so that's literal violence. Structural violence is when you are depriving a social group of their ability to live without oppression, without harm, without fear. And so that is, it's not necessarily a kind of violence that is perpetrated against individual to individual. It's not literally that you're hitting somebody, you are hurting them all the same. And so structural violence manifests through public policy choices. And this is an important concept because like you can't have a positive peace. So like a negative peace is peace through the manipulation of fear and risk, right? Deterrence. So like you don't have war, but you don't have war because of sort of negative peace reasoning. So it's like you're just talking about the minimum threshold of like no war. That's very different from a positive peace where the kind of violence that's missing is structural violence. A positive peace, you have actual equality, you have solidarity, you have people living conditions of freedom basically, but not freedom in the weird American sense where it's like I can piss all over you and that's my right, or I'm allowed to say things that like fucking antagonize you. Not freedom in that sense, freedom in the sense that you can make the choices in life that like satisfy you, that you can have all of your basic needs as a human being met, and that you can express, you have the ability to exercise your own political rights. And so structural violence is decisions that the state makes or that groups make, governments make, that deprive you of that. And so this is important because where there is structural violence, there's all kinds of studies that have shown that you get actual violence, you get literal violence. Underlying cause of conflict, international, I mean, at an individual level, but also internationally. And this is one of the things that's like a blind spot for liberal internationalism, because liberal internationalism does not attend to structural violence. And that's a problem because it means that you're always, you care about preventing war, but the way to ultimately prevent war is to ensure equality and enfranchisement, to take care of the global commons, right? You're providing a framework for action and for thinking that encourages non-war for reasons other than the manipulation of fear and risk. And so you have to buy down structural violence in order to actually make a more peaceful world. It's the best, most effective, most durable way of preventing the war that you want to prevent, that you care about ultimately, even in like security studies. And so this is one of the things that the left has as kind of like an intellectual advantage over others, I think. The left sucks at articulating a kind of security agenda or like a foreign policy vision, generally speaking, but implicit in their worldview is the need to address structural violence because it's an underlying cause of actual violence. Once this concept is in your imagination, it creates all kinds of possibilities for how you think about statecraft and how you think about using public policy to make a like better world or a more peaceful world, you know? So that's what structural violence is. And a lot of foreign policy decisions create structural violence. And since structural violence is a cause of actual violence, that's a huge problem. And structural violence weakens governance. It creates authoritarianism. It encourages corruption. We should care if a foreign policy decision makes structural violence worse. And one of the things, one of my like real sources of like hostility toward China is that for two decades, even in the good era, quote unquote, with China, their foreign policy was systematically expanding structural violence within its own periphery with small states, through these fucking strategic comprehensive partnerships. And they got a pass on it because we all wanted to get rich. Now, some of that thinking is getting reversed. But even now, none of the hawks, I've never heard a fucking hawk in my life use the phrase structural violence. They don't care about this stuff.
Yeah.
But they should. Yeah, everybody they should.
Thanks for that. So the second question this week is from Rob York, a program director at Pacific Forum. Do you think Edward Snowden deserves pardoning? Does the public good of what he revealed outweigh the negatives?
So this is going to be an unpopular answer, probably an unpopular answer with Rob, but probably also an unpopular answer with Jake. I was in government when the Snowden revelations came out, and I don't think that there was a public good in what he released. People can dispute that, but the secrets he divulged, there was no smoking gun in any of it. Like, we knew, as a matter of practice, the contours of everything he released. America spies on its friends. Oh, fucking knock me over with a feather. Who fucking would have thought?
You know? Guessed,
perish the thought. Like, fuck, man. And so, like, and what he did release, can't talk about the inside stuff, right? But there were real damage to, like, Intel assets and to the U.S. position in the world and its ability to collect the information it needs to prevent terrorist attacks and the like was negatively affected by his leaks. And the upshot of what we learned was not new. And so, like, the only way that I think you can venerate Edward Snowden is if you're like a staunch ideological believer in anti-secrecy. Like, if you believe in transparency, no matter the cost, like, though the heavens fall, truth be told kind of thing, then it makes sense to support Snowden, even though you need to weigh that cost benefit against the damage that was done. But I just don't see the upside, man. I feel like this guy was on a kind of like narcissistic ego trip thing. And he's just framing it as like he's being a hero. This is Miles Guak of transparency. You know, like, you're claiming to be the hero, but actually you're just serving yourself.
Well, look, funny you mentioned at the start that I might disagree with you, Van, but I don't follow the fetishization of Snowden and WikiLeaks in the Marxist sphere. I really don't understand it to that extent, because you're right. Like, the information we gleaned, like, what did it do? Reinforce our worldview, I guess.
Yeah, like, it was like confirmation really bias, basically.
But the cost was so great, and I can only imagine what the real cost was, like, in the Pentagon at the time. But it's sort of, you just got to pick your fights, and we already knew this is already an issue. So, like, this, it's really not a leftist thing, the Snowden thing. It's really not. I think it's an opportunist. It's purely an opportunist thing, like you said, man.
Yeah, no, that's interesting that we're on the same side on this. Like, I understood, I feel like people reflexively, anyone who takes risks in opposing the state is somehow like in your camp, but like that's too low of a bar.
Dangerous.
You know?
Yep, exactly. That's how we get.
That's how you end up allies with QAnon. Yeah. Like fucking.
Yep.
You got to be more discerning than that, you know?
Really quickly, Van. So do you think, sorry, Kira. To confirm, you do think that the public good didn't outweigh the negative, but do you think he deserves a pardon or not? Like, do you think
No, he doesn't. He's a criminal. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sure. He's basically a narcissistic criminal who is now posing as a hero of liberty because that's his best chance at redemption.
I'm aware that we are tight on time, but how do you feel about Chelsea Manning?
Oh yeah, good question.
If this is how you feel about Snowden, do you feel the same way about Manning?
Basically, yes. They both committed a form of treason. The Chelsea Manning's motivations were clearly tied up in her identity or whatever. I mean, she was going through some shit, you know. And again, I think she was not trying to serve the public good primarily. I think she was going through some shit and in like inner turmoil and with like gender change and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that comes out of like some of the emails that she was writing at the time. Like there was clearly inner angst, and this was the leaks were like a manifestation of it. Her leaks, I don't think were as damaging, but it was still breaking the law.
Is there any mechanism in the United States system where that information could have been made public at all one day? Not so much Edward Snowden, but with Manning, like the information that she was trying to get out, is there any chance that could have ever been made public?
Yeah, sort of, yes and no. You can always file Freedom of Information Act requests.
Okay.
And if it's going to be, if the revealing of the information is going to be damaging, then they can claim state secrets or whatever and deny the request. But unless they make that justification, they have to release the information.
So the third question is from the Smelly Stoic. How do you think Kamala Harris's criminal justice background will resonate within the BLM wing of the Democratic voter base? Is it not self-sabotaging?
She has a mixed record on criminal justice issues because she was a, you know, prosecutor, attorney general. I think this is the question about like visual representation versus policy representation, right? On a policy level, a lot of people in the Black Lives Matter movement have issues with her, right? But I mean, across the board, everybody loves her as a visual representation of the Black Lives Matter movement. She's vocally supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement. The thing about her criminal justice background is that if you came up in politics in the 90s, which she did, criminal justice was the thing, like especially for Democrats, like tough on crime.
Yeah.
And so she was buying into the zeitgeist of politics of her day. She was making the smart political move. And it's not like she's some Rudy Giuliani, you know, true believer in the sanctity of the police over the people or something. Like it was her criminal justice path was opportunistic. It was about playing a smart political game. And you could be very concerned about her because of that. Because she was basically a politician. But I mean, that's a critique that you would level against any politician. It's not like unique to her. And I think the good thing about that, if I'm trying to sell her, which I'm not on her team right now. I just like her. If you're trying to be sympathetic to her, it's that she will represent the Black Lives Matter movement well and support police reforms well, because that is in the zeitgeist now. That's what's popular now. So the more that you can make the politically popular thing a good thing, I think she'll be in line with that. Like she's not going to be backing, you know, Blue Lives Matter or whatever the fuck over Black Lives Matter. There are tensions in her background with the Black community, but she's also probably a better representative than a lot of other alternative choices. I think on policy, Warren really is the best for Blacks. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, she's the best for the working class.
Yes.
Elizabeth Warren. And that's coming from a Marxist, and I don't like some of her positions, but she really is objectively the best choice. I understand that Kamala Harris is a great choice and a great representation, but like, it just seems a bit silly to me that like months after there's this huge protest movement about defunding the police and the criminal justice system that's been inherently broken for years, and then he chooses the next prosecutor to run for his VP. It's like, yeah, holy shit, timing on point, man.
Yeah, she will definitely make smart political choices, and yeah, that's very Biden-esque, you know what I mean? Like, that is going to be way better than Trump, but it is not going to get us to the mountaintop. And so, like, Noam Chomsky had this great line that he said, his recommendation to leftists, it was vote for Biden and then haunt his dreams. And
that's
the take, you know, like, go all in supporting the lesser evils, if that's how you want to view it, or these people who give you half a loaf instead of everything you want politically, but use your support as the basis to challenge them and make them make right choices, you know? All right, man. People, that's going to do it. WPR.pub/undiplomatic for the World Politics Review newsletter, and buymeacoffee.com/undiplomatic for sending us money. And if you want to throw us a review on Apple or wherever you listen to the podcast, we'll not be mad at that. Love it. All right.
Peace.